It's Friday the 12th of June, day 83. I've been a keen photographer since I was a teenager. I never aspired to do it for a living, especially after a publisher asked me if I'd be interested in writing a book about David Bailey, who was then the enfant terrible of London fashion photography. And after a brief investigation of that milieu and its mores, I gracefully declined the commission. As I grew older, the photographers I came to admire most were photojournalists like Henri Cartier-Bresson and Bill Brandt, war photographers like Don McCullen, and fine art photographers like Edward Weston and Ansel Adams. I met Adams once at the launch of an exhibition of his work at the V&A in London. He was a very large, tall man with an impressive beard, dressed in a lumberjack shirt and heavy boots, towering over the smartly dressed London glitterati at the show like a giant redwood in a copse of saplings. Like thousands of other people, I was blown away by his wonderful landscape photography, especially of the great American national parks. When I first went to Yosemite in the summer of 1990, I brought my cameras thinking that I would take some pictures. But when I got there, I found myself unable to take a single shot. Because I knew his work so intimately, it seemed absolutely futile to try and compete. So I put the cameras back in the bag, found a quiet bend in the Merced River, stripped off and went for a swim in its crystal clear waters, to the consternation of my late wife, who sat nervously on the bank waiting for a park ranger to arrive and arrest me for unauthorized nudity in a sacred place. The mid-20th century was the high point of photojournalism, largely because of the existence of highly profitable news magazines like Life and the colour supplements of broadsheet newspapers, institutions which could afford to hire great snappers and give them resources and time to do the kind of storytelling they did best. But then it all started to fall apart. The internet arrived, and particularly the web, and suddenly the business model of print journalism evaporated. And after that, digital cameras arrived, which made it virtually impossible for anyone to take photographs that weren't at least properly focused and exposed. And then digital also embraced video, so everyone could make movies. And the coup de grâce came when these amazing devices were embedded in smartphones, so that everybody carried a capable video camera in their pockets. With the results we've seen these last 2 weeks, as the murder of George Floyd was recorded live and flashed across the world. So I'd begun to believe that the great days of photojournalism, at least as regards still photography, might be over. It was good while it lasted, I thought, but it was now history. And then I logged onto the New York Times site this morning and found an amazing piece of photojournalism that Cartier-Bresson or any of his colleagues from the Magnum agency would have recognised as a paradigm of the genre that they had pioneered. What had happened was that the Times had sent a writer and a photographer together to pandemic-gripped Europe, where they rented a car and drove through 6 countries and recorded in words and still pictures what they saw and overheard. The result is a vivid, and of course impressionistic, but nevertheless compelling, piece of reportage. It reminded me instantly of what Walker Evans and James Agee had done when in 1936 Fortune magazine sent them to the deep south of the United States at the height, or do I mean the depth, of the Great Depression, to record the lives of poor sharecroppers in that part of the country. And from that trip came a marvellous, compelling book with the title Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, that comes from a verse in the Old Testament that reads, Let us now praise famous men, and our fathers that begat us. There is one thing about the Times report, I suppose, of which Cartier-Bresson would not have approved, the fact that it was the product of a partnership between a wordsmith and a photographer. His fabulous travelogues, I'm thinking in particular of his time in India around the death of Gandhi, or his visit to my own country, Ireland, in the 1950s, allowed only his pictures to tell the story. But to my mind, the New York Times experiment of having sparse words and powerful pictures memorably telling a story suggests the rebirth of a great journalistic genre in which the whole can be greater than the sum of its parts. So the best may be yet to come, again.